it is Thursday, June 4th, and welcome to Create 24. I'm your host, Alana Hill. The Democratic Party scored a broad victory in local elections, while the opposition People Power Party held Seoul and key Conservative strongholds. We'll have more on that in News Briefing. On In Depth, we look at what the results mean for the country's political landscape going forward. And on Explore Korea, we're delving into a major new exhibition by internationally acclaimed Korean artist Lee Bae. Let's start Korea 24 right now. The party swept to a victory by clinching 12 of 16 key races in the June 3rd local elections, while the main opposition People Power Party won the highly contested race for Seoul and retained three Conservative strongholds in the southeast. For more on the elections and other major headlines of the day, we have now in the studio with us Deputy Editor-in-Chief of KBS World's English News Service, Kim In-kyung. Hello, In-kyung.
Hello, Alana.
In-kyung, the election tally is in. What did the results show?
Well, there was a landslide win for the Democratic Party, which secured 12 of the 16 key mayoral and gubernatorial races. It clinched wins in Busan, Incheon, Gyeonggi, Gangwon, the Jeolla and Chungcheong provinces, pretty much everywhere except for the southeast. The People Power Party took only four, but it secured a crown jewel, Seoul. Seoul is just one of 16, but it has around a fifth of South Korea's population and is the center of commerce, politics and culture. So it's highly symbolic. So the PPP's Oh Se-hoon became the face of Wednesday's elections when he came from behind to win against the DP's Jeong Won-ho this morning, regardless of the razor-thin margin. Let's take a listen to what Oh said after securing his fifth term for Seoul mayor.
시민 여러분께서는 견제와 균형이라는 민주주의의 대원칙을 다시 한번 확고하게 세워주셨습니다.
Seoul citizens have once again firmly established the fundamental principle of democracy, checks and balances. You have preserved Seoul as the final bulwark of democracy to prevent the Republic of Korea from tilting completely to one side.
국민 위에 설 수 없다는 사실을 시민 여러분께서 분명하게 보여주셨습니다.
The People Power Party also held on to the conservative strongholds of South and North Gyeongsang provinces and the city of Daegu, but the fact that the races in Daegu and South Gyeongsang province were neck and neck shows just how much ground the party has lost as the elections came on the heels of former President Yoon's declaration of martial law and his impeachment.
Now, 14 parliamentary by-elections were held concurrently with the local elections. In-kyung, what happened there?
The PPP had a better-than-expected outcome there because it managed to flip some seats. Of the 14 seats, 13 were previously held by the DP and just one by the PPP. But the DP won 9 seats and the PPP grabbed 4. Independent Han Dong-hoon, a former PPP leader who was pushed out by the current leader Chang Dong-hyuk, won in Busan's Bukgap district.
And how did the two parties assess the election results?
The DP said a victory is a victory, even if the outcome is disappointing. The PPP said it protected the embers of hope.
Well, let's now turn to the ballot shortage in Seoul. And can you break down exactly what happened?
Sure. Shortages were reported across multiple stations in the Jamsil area from around 1 p.m. And by 4:30 p.m., voting had stopped entirely at some locations. Polls officially closed at 6 p.m., but the National Election Commission extended voting hours at these sites. Then hundreds of people gathered in front of the National Election Commission's headquarters in Gwacheon, Gyeonggi Province, as well as a polling station in Jamsil to protest. They demanded that the commission suspend vote counting and hold a re-election. Police were deployed to the scene to prepare for emergencies as demonstrations persisted overnight into Thursday.
And is this standoff still in place?
Yes, it is. Election officials and administrators are trapped inside the Jamsil polling station. Two ballot boxes are still inside, holding around 14,000 ballots representing 2,000 voters. The Election Commission apologized but said a shortage of ballots does not constitute grounds for a re-election. The commission pledged to investigate the cause of the incident and establish an independent fact-finding committee.
And what are the rival parties saying about this ballot shortage?
They are united in rebuking the commission. The DP said the commission's secretary general should consider stepping down. The PPP called for his immediate ouster, followed by a parliamentary investigation. But the PPP dropped its demands for a revote after Oh Se-hoon was re-elected as Seoul mayor.
And what about President Lee Jae-myung?
Well, he expressed deep regret, too, during a meeting with his senior secretaries on Thursday. He said an incomprehensible weakness has emerged in election management. He called on related agencies to identify what caused the ballot shortages and hold those responsible to account. He also demanded measures to ensure the people's right to vote is never compromised again.
Well, meanwhile, Prime Minister Kim In-suk is expected to resign soon to run for chief of the Democratic Party, and President Lee is said to be considering three people as his replacement. Give us the details there.
Sure. According to officials at the presidential office and the DP on Thursday, Lee's chief of staff Kang Eun-sik, Justice Minister Jung Sung-ho, and SMEs and Startups Minister Han Sung-soo are in the running to replace Kim. At the earliest, an announcement is likely to come within the week. Kim is likely to step down to run in the DP convention set to be held in August or September. He's expected to run against current DP chief Jung Chung-nae, who received a boost from the elections.
And finally for today, the North State-run Korean Central News Agency says leader Kim Jong-un has inspected a new nuclear material production facility and declared his resolve to strengthen the regime's nuclear force. In-kyung, what else can you tell us?
The KCNA said Kim conducted a field inspection at the newly opened plant on Wednesday but didn't release further details about the facility. North Korea is currently believed to operate three uranium enrichment facilities, one in Yongbyon and another in Gusong in North Pyongan province, and the third in Namp'o City's Gangseon area. Kim said the country's capacity to produce weapons-grade nuclear material has more than doubled during the past 5 years, and that a new five-year plan was finalized at the 9th Party Congress to further expand the capacity and the number of nuclear weapons the regime has in its possession. Kim said North Korea has an urgent responsibility to expand its nuclear deterrence capabilities and that its nuclear forces would guarantee its combat efficacy and protect its interests.
And that's about a wrap up today's news briefing. Thank you so much, In-kyung, for bringing us all the headlines.
Thank you, Alana.
We are the champion of BTO online.
This is two-time Stanley Cup champion Jim Pak, the head coach for HL Anyang. You are now listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio.
The Democratic Party clinched a resounding victory in the local elections and parliamentary by-elections. The DP won 12 out of the 16 key mayoral and gubernatorial seats up for grabs, including the cities of Busan, Incheon and Gyeonggi Province, while the main opposition People Power Party took the highly contested Seoul and North and South Gyeongsang Province, as well as the city of Daegu. Of the total 14 seats contested in the parliamentary by-elections, which were held concurrently with the local elections, the DP secured 9, followed by the PPP with 4 seats, while the remaining seat was won by an independent. To take a closer look at the election results and what they mean for the political landscape going forward, we're joined today on the line by two guests. First, we have Brian Myers, Professor of International Studies at Dongseo University in Busan. Great to have you with us, Professor Myers.
It's great to be with you.
We also have Kim Hina, Professor of Political Science at the Sogang University Graduate School of International Studies. Hello, Professor Kim.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Well, Wednesday's elections, they were the first nationwide vote since President Lee Jae-myung took office a year ago. They were widely seen as a test of public support for President Lee as well as his administration, as the conservative bloc's chances of recovering from the political turmoil that followed former President Yoon Suk-yeol's 2024 martial law declaration. First off, Professor Kim, can we get your overall assessment of the election results? What do you think they tell us about the current public sentiment?
Right. So as you mentioned, the Democratic Party won 12 out of 16 races, while the People Power Party secured victories in Seoul, Daegu, and North and South Gyeongsang Province, which are traditional conservative strongholds. But the DP captured major regions, as you mentioned earlier, but it was given a clear majority nationwide. Now, however, the DP lost momentum in Seoul, where the race shifted dramatically in the final stretch. And in many ways, this election also saw controversies over ballot shortages and closely contested races, which made it one of the most closely watched elections in recent years. Overall, the results suggest a very complex public mood. On one hand, there appears to be dissatisfaction with the opposition. On the other hand, voters are also expressing a desire to keep the ruling party in check. So the DP won enough races to claim an overall victory, but many within the party may still view the outcome with some disappointment after losing several major cities and symbolic battlegrounds. And the results highlighted both the political polarization that's present right now in Korea, as well as the resilience of its democratic system. The competitive nature of the election, combined with strong voter turnout, demonstrated how multiple political forces continue to shape and balance the country's political landscape.
Professor Mars, let me bring you in here as well. Do you read the results the same way, or are you seeing a different message from voters?
Well, there's a difference between the public mood in Seoul and the mood everywhere else. As I see it, Seoul was the one city where these elections really were a referendum on the administration, because the main problem there is the unaffordability of housing. And rightly or wrongly, that is seen as the result of the administration's missteps. Whereas in the provinces where I live and work, people are worried most about the lack of jobs for young people and the steady shrinking of cities, the increase in the numbers of shops and restaurants that have to close down. And those problems have been plaguing the provinces for so long that people don't blame them on President Lee. On the contrary, many voters think we're going to need help from the central government, so we might as well have a mayor or governor who is on good terms with the Blue House and not fighting against it. And I heard ruling party candidates around the country explicitly saying that. I heard Kim Boo-gyum say that in Daegu. I heard Chun Jae-su say it in Busan. And more often than not, I think that reasoning did work. And I think that's why the Democratic Party did carry so many races.
Mm-hmm. And just to reiterate for listeners, the DP won 12 of the 16 key mayoral and gubernatorial races. The PPP did hold on to Seoul and its traditional conservative strongholds in Daegu and the Gyeongsang provinces. Professor Meyer, what do you think the DP and the PPP are going to be interpreting from these results?
Well, this is such a centralized country with so much symbolic capital concentrated in Seoul that I think the opposition party's victory in the mayoral race there alone makes this quite a respectable outcome for it, which is why the conservative talk shows and podcasts have been so much more cheerful today than the progressive ones. I always say to Americans, you need to imagine what it would be like if New York City contained not only Wall Street, but also the U.S. government, the entire Ivy League, Hollywood, and about 20% of the U.S. population, because if you can imagine that, you get an idea of how important Seoul is. Mm-hmm. So if you give a party here the choice between winning Seoul plus another big city plus two provinces or winning everything else, I think even the ruling party would be very tempted to choose the former. Mm-hmm. So my impression is that the PPP is very relieved by this outcome, which is certainly better than the blowout it suffered under a different name in 2018, whereas the ruling party is disappointed. They were so confident going into these elections. They were hoping even to take Daegu, and they fell far short of that. And what makes this bitter for the left wing is that this defeat probably has less to do with deep ideological reasons than with miscalculations, missteps, wrong tactical decisions, and so on. Mm-hmm. Often when the ruling party lost, it was only by a very small margin, and that includes, of course, Seoul.
Professor Kim, I'd like to get your view as well. How do you think each party is likely to read these results, the DP's more broader wins and the PPP's hold on Seoul and its conservative strongholds?
Right, so I completely agree with Professor Myers. You know, the DP may initially kind of point to its the sweep of its majority as a clear popular mandate for President Lee Jae-myung. And the scale of the victory was in this way anticipated given his approval ratings and many other reasons. But at the same time, the DP faces a lot of uncomfortable truths. Now, experts have argued that the DP needs not just a majority, but a landslide, including a win in the Seoul mayor race, to really deliver or to show that Lee is a truly decisive boost. But this didn't happen. Oh Se-hoon of the PPP won in a dramatic reversal. And this went against the exit polls as well. So the loss of Seoul in this kind of dramatic reversal is quite symbolic, and this will sting the DP. Mm-hmm. And the situation in Pyeongtaek, where progressive vote splitting between the two candidates handed the PPP an unexpected win, further underscores that the liberal camp's internal visions have not been fully resolved. Meanwhile, the PPP will frame the outcome as a resilient performance against formidable odds. Oh Se-hoon's victory in Seoul stands as the party's most symbolic significant win, and combined with holdings in its traditional strongholds, the party has enough material to argue that it defended its core ground despite operating under the long shadow of the Yoon impeachment. But there are far more uncomfortable messages embedded in these results. For example, Han Dong-won's victory in Busan as an independent candidate after a tight race is perhaps the most telling signal. You know, voters chose to back a prominent conservative figure while simultaneously rejecting the PPP label itself. So in other words, the party's brand remains somewhat damaged. And a deeper reading of this is that the Korean public has not abandoned conservatism, but they are clearly demanding a conservatism that it has made a genuine and visible break away from the Yoon era. So voters are differentiated sharply between individual conservative candidates that they find credible and the PPP as an institution that they still hold accountable for the martial law crisis. So in many ways, this is an ongoing issue in this way.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we discuss the results more, I want to actually turn to the voting process itself, because it's actually raised a lot of questions and some controversy over how the election was handled in parts of Seoul. Professor Kim, you've touched on the ballot shortage. The National Election Commission has issued a public apology after dozens of polling stations in Seoul suffered disruptions in voting for Wednesday's local elections due to shortages of ballot papers. The commission says such a shortage does not constitute grounds for postponement of the election or a re-election under the Public Official Election Act. However, the PPP has demanded the vote count be suspended and that re-elections be held in Seoul. Professor Myers, what do you make of this incident?
Well, it's just one more black mark against an electoral commission which has been at the center of controversy for several years now. And it's things like this which unfortunately shake the public trust in the integrity of the whole voting process. It's really quite baffling that they had so few ballot papers available, and when in fact the district in question is one that usually has a very high voter turnout. It's perhaps just as well that the opposition candidate won, and by a large enough margin, because if the ruling party man had won by, say, only 1,000 or 2,000 votes, then I think a real political crisis might well have ensued. Mm-hmm. As it is, I think the margin of victory has obviated the need for a recount. But this is one election that is always going to have to carry an asterisk next to the number of votes recorded. And the mess up is such that a mere apology from the Electoral Commission is just not going to be enough to restore trust in the process, I'm afraid.
Professor Kim, I want to get your thoughts on this incident as well, and what should be done to prevent similar incidents from happening again?
Right. So what happened was more than a simple administrative error. It really did expose deeper institutional weaknesses. As Professor Myers mentioned, you know, the number of votes is going to have an asterisk next to it because there were at least 14 polling stations across Seoul in Songpa, Gangnam and Gwangjin, you know, that ran out of ballot papers. And this left a lot of voters waiting in line for 2 to 3 hours. There were also a lot of videos online earlier today that were showing these voters just waiting outside in the middle of the night. And NEC Secretary General Heo Chul-hun apologized, acknowledging that the commission had caused great confusion and concern. And voting hours were extended at these affected stations. But as was mentioned earlier, an apology at this point may simply not be enough. And to kind of understand why, you have to look at the NEC's broader track record. This is not the institution's first encounter with controversy. The Board of Audit and Inspection found that NEC officials ranging from senior executives to mid-level managers had systematically solicited positions for their family members, with recruitment officers manipulating interview scores, forging documents, and forming interview panels stacked with personal connections. And in total, 878 violations of recruitment regulations were confirmed across 291 rounds of hiring since 2013. So the bigger problem here is that when an agency has a track record of nepotism, internal cover-ups, and repeated operational failures, even an innocent logistical error becomes fertile ground for conspiracy theories. And the NEC essentially handed ammunition to those who wished to question the election's legitimacy. And that's an institutional failure as much as a logistical one. And South Korea's democracy is mature enough that by any international standard, competitive and credibly, it should be competitively and credibly administered. But this time, the NEC has accumulated an issue and has in the past accumulated enough controversy that this is going to be considered an unaddressed failure.
Mm-hmm. Professor Myers, I want to ask, in your opinion, do you think that this unprecedented shortage of ballot papers should lead to a re-election?
I don't think that the number of uncounted votes is sufficient to make that necessary. I think that won by a large enough margin that it probably would not make much of a difference if they were recounted. But I would think that to restore the public's trust in the electoral process, it probably should be done.
Mm-hmm.
I think those districts should have another election take place, in my opinion.
Well, let's now talk about the parliamentary by-elections. The results of the 14 parliamentary by-elections held concurrently with the local elections returned a better than expected outcome for the People Power Party. While the Democratic Party won 9 seats, the PPP captured 4. An independent candidate, Han Dong-hoon, won in Busan's Buk-ae district. One of the most closely watched races was Busan's Buk-ae district, where independent candidate Han clinched victory over DP candidate Ha Jung-woo. Han has called the result a historic victory, and he's pledged to honour the mandate from voters. His win marks a striking political comeback after his expulsion from the party earlier this year, and is likely to fuel debate within the PPP over whether he should be allowed to return. Professor Myers, what's your take on Han's victory, and do you think he will be allowed to return to the PPP?
Well, you know, Busan people take a long time to open up to a newcomer. So for Han to move to that district just months before the election and then beat both a ruling party candidate handpicked by President Lee and the opposition party candidate is pretty impressive. You know, for years, we've all had this impression of him as a kind of media creation, as somebody who was backed by the conservative press, but may not have had the appeal that the press was attributing to him. But now we see he really does know how to connect to voters. So I think there will be talk, there already is talk, in fact, of not only bringing him back into the party, but also of letting him reshape the party according to his own vision for it. And I think people are forgetting that he didn't do a very good job of that before the general elections that the People Power Party lost. So I think there's going to be opposition to this from the elderly rank and file, and even from younger conservatives who still regard him as a traitor for having allegedly betrayed the last president, President Yoon. Mm-hmm. So at any rate, I think this is going to mean more bickering and dissent inside the PPP of the kind that the party has become notorious for.
Well, let's now zoom out from individual races and look at what these results could mean for the PPP as a whole. As we've touched on, the party has been grappling with the political consequences of former President Yoon's removal from office after his failed martial law declaration. Professor Kim, what will the election results mean for PPP leader Jang Dong-hyuk? Do you expect to see a change in leadership within the party? And what should the PPP do to regain public trust and bounce back?
I think Jang Dong-hyuk's response to this result, to the results, was telling. He described the outcome as a disappointing result, but one that kept the flame of hope alive. And he pledged to find a new path forward with party members. So in other words, despite the scale of defeat, he drew a clear line against calls for accountability and signaled his intention to serve out his full term as party leader. Now, the tension within the PPP is real and structural. On one hand, the results did produce some notably pro-Yoon victories. Chu Kyung-ho, a figure directly associated with the Yoon impeachment saga, won the Daegu mayoral race. Lee Jin-suk, a staunch Yoon loyalist, won the Daegu Dalseong by-election. And these results imply that the Yoonagan faction within the party is likely to retain meaningful influence, particularly in the traditional conservative heartland. Jang will likely point to these wins as proof that the party base remains intact and that there is no urgent mandate for leadership change. But the full picture through that lens alone would be a serious mistake. As mentioned earlier, the voters most willing to return to conservatism are also the ones most eager to see it reformed. And the results make that unmistakably clear. As we talked about earlier, Han Dong-un's win in Busan precisely was based on this, because he was running away from the party and not towards it. And Oh Se-hoon's victory in Seoul was not a triumph of the PPP brand. It was a triumph of a particular kind of conservative politician. So in other words, there are voters, many voters, who were not choosing the PPP, but they were choosing conservatives who had credibly separated themselves from it. So if the PPP is serious about rebuilding, the path is not comfortable, but the party needs to make an unambiguous break from the Yoon era. And it needs to present a new generation of leadership that is credible to voters beyond the southeastern strongholds.
Professor Myers, what about the ruling DP? Do you think the DP's victories in Wednesday's elections will solidify party leader Jung Chung-rae's position despite that loss in Seoul?
Well, you know, it's funny because these elections, particularly the loss of Kim Kyung-soo in the gubernatorial race in South Gyeongsang and Cho Guk's defeat in the Pyeongtaek by-election, they've probably weakened the pro-Moon faction inside the left. So the faction of people who are still loyal to the former president, Moon Jae-in. And those people have had a pretty rocky relationship with Jung Chung-nae in the past. So their gradual fading from relevance may be good for him. But I don't think that this outcome is good enough to solidify his position. Of course, the loss of Seoul is not really his fault. He did not pick that candidate to run for mayor. That was President Lee who did that. Jung has made other missteps that the press has made a lot of, but he's done nothing that left a really deep, bad impression on voters. Now, had the ruling party lost North Chulla province to the independent candidate, that would really have been a blow to his prestige. But as things stand now, I don't think he's going to be pressured to stand down. But he, I think, will face a strong challenge from Song Yong-gil when he seeks re-election as a party leader later this year.
Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, that's all that we have time for today. My thanks to Brian Myers, Professor of International Studies at Dongseo University. Great to have you with us today, Professor Myers.
Thank you for having me.
And Professor Kim Hina of Sogang University's Graduate School of International Studies. Thank you so much, Professor Kim, for sharing your insights.
Thanks for having me as well.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock Market Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index slid 162.08 points, or 1.84% on Thursday, to close at 8,639.41. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ gained 23.7 points, or 2.31%, to close at 1,049.73. You can check Korean stock market updates at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next, we are joined by Daniel Che for our Korea Trending segment. For this part of the show, we check out some of the most viewed stories and issues covered by Korean news outlets and handpicked by the Korea 24 team. Hello, Daniel.
Hello there, Alana.
Daniel, what's our starting point today?
South Korea's national men's football team was victorious against El Salvador in the last friendly held ahead of the World Cup.
Okay, give us a recap of the match, of course, starting with the final score.
The Taeguk Warriors had a 1-0 win over El Salvador on Wednesday at the match held at the Brigham Young University Southfield in Provo, Utah, over in the U.S. Yoo Dong-young's free kick in the 57th minute being the only goal and the main difference maker there. Many criticized South Korea's performance, though, saying they didn't play like a superior team that outranked its opponents by 75 spots in the FIFA rankings.
And just for a reminder, how does this compare to Korea's previous two friendlies?
Well, the disappointment is understandable as Korea demonstrated incredible firepower just a few days back on Saturday when they held Trinidad and Tobago scoreless while scorching the net five times. So they did not look like the same team against El Salvador, though some experts pointed out that El Salvador was much more physical and pressed Korea's midfielders harder than Trinidad and Tobago. While Korea boasted 72% in ball possession, they were mostly involved lateral and back passes than forward ones.
So why weren't Team Korea able to get the result this time, or the better result this time? Were injuries or missing players a big part of it?
We actually have very little excuse this time. Team Korea, in fact, boasted a star-studded lineup, including starting forward Cho Kyu-sung, who had a size advantage over El Salvador defenders, but he barely received any passes in the box. Korea's premier defensive linchpin, Kim Min-jae, roamed the field too, but the trio of defenders, including Kim, didn't display great chemistry together, lacking quick passes to relieve pressure. Son Heung-min, Lee Kang-in, and Oh Yeon-kyu, likely starters at the World Cup, did come off the bench past the hour mark, but many of the shots were off target. Korea didn't look sharp in set-piece chances either.
Listen, it was just a friendly, but should this be a concern for Team Korea, or is this too early to be talking about major changes? How did the head coach respond after the match?
Hong Myung-bo said he didn't want to reveal too much in the friendly matches as his World Cup opponents might be watching and studying. He said his players will try to sharpen set pieces when they get to Mexico for the World Cup. All three World Cup group stage matches for Team Korea will be held in Mexico. And according to the Ministry of Culture, Sports and Tourism, various K-culture events, festivals will be held in Mexico in tandem with the World Cup. Through the Korean Embassy and the Korean Cultural Center in Mexico, they will feature contents that bridge Korean tradition and contemporary culture while expanding bilateral cultural exchanges.
Right. So while the result was essentially positive, it sounds like there's still some areas Korea will need to tighten up with before the World Cup gets underway. Let's move on now to our next story.
The South Korean government is taking action to stop various unfair practices by accommodation businesses in venues near major K-pop events, namely the upcoming BTS concert in the southern port city of Busan, set to be held on the 12th and 13th of this month.
Okay, Daniel, get us up to speed with the measures that are set to be implemented.
So on Thursday, the Ministry of Finance and Economy announced related measures at a meeting of a special task force that handles price gouging issues, among others. Some of the measures include setting up regulations to sanction unilateral cancellation of reservations without justifiable reasons. For instance, a lodging business that unilaterally cancels an existing reservation for the purpose of raising the price and reselling it will be required to return the down payment and reimburse an additional 200% of the canceled accommodation fee. The government is also pushing for the introduction of a system that requires accommodation companies to report the upper limit of accommodation rates by a set period to local governments and to publicly disclose them.
But beyond setting standard rates and cracking down on unreasonable cancellations or price gouging, what about the possibility of accommodation shortages? Does the government have any contingency plans in place if demand outstrips supply?
Yes, they do. To ease accommodation shortages, the government plans to secure about 1,300 alternative lodging spaces using university dorms, public training centers, youth facilities, and religious institutions even. Busan City has also launched additional measures, including a homestay program that allows local residents to host visitors during the concert period.
And how serious is the BTS concert-related accommodation price gouging and cancellation issue in Busan?
According to the government, there have been more than 300 complaints about accommodation inconveniences received regarding BTS Busan performances. Some 82% were about cancellations, and more than 15% were about high prices.
Have BTS members themselves said anything about the accommodation price concerns?
Back on May 26th, in a live broadcast of the fan platform Weverse, held after the American Music Awards, leader RM touched on the issue and said that while he understands there may be price fluctuations during certain seasons, but he also highlighted the need to be reasonable. Jimin, a Busan native, also expressed concerns, adding that he hoped fans will only make good memories in the port city.
Well, it sounds like both the government and the band are hoping fans can focus on enjoying the concerts rather than worrying about where they'll stay. Danielle, what's our final story for today?
We talked about NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang's planned visit to Korea and the possible itinerary. We now have confirmation that he will be at a baseball stadium at a game. Not only that, he will be throwing the ceremonial first pitch.
Well, it's fair to say you have to be a pretty big name to be invited to throw the ceremonial first pitch in the KBO. So tell us, which team's home game will Jensen Huang be appearing at?
The Seoul-based Doosan Bears announced Thursday that Huang will be at their home game against the Kyum Heroes on Sunday at the Jamsil Baseball Stadium. Huang is set to step up to the mound to do the honors at 5 p.m. That's slightly before the game starts.
And is he going to be the sole celebrity involved in the ceremony, or are there other stars set to join him?
One more will be joining in when Huang pitches. Doosan Group Chair Park Jung-won, who is also the owner of the Doosan Bears baseball team, will be at the plate ready to swing away as a ceremonial batter. The NVIDIA chief will don a Bears jersey with number 93, marking the year he founded the company, 1993. Park will be wearing 96 to reflect the Doosan Group's founding year, 1896.
And is this going to be an all-new experience for Huang, or has he been in the spotlight in the baseball diamond before?
He is known to be a longtime baseball enthusiast with ample experience in ceremonial pitches, as he has delivered not only in Taiwan's Chinese Professional Baseball League, but also in the sport's biggest stage, Major League Baseball, or MLB. Huang is expected to arrive in South Korea as early as Thursday evening for a series of meetings with business leaders, industry figures, and even students.
Well, that's all we have for today's edition of Korea Trending. Thank you so much, Daniel, for bringing us all the stories.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hello, I'm violinist Clara Jumi Kang. You are now listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio.
To our weekly segment, Explore Korea, our time to adventure across the peninsula and uncover hidden stories and cultural gems. And joining us this week is Lee Ji-an, a reporter from the Korea Jeonnang Daily. Welcome back, Ji-an.
Hi, Alana.
Okay, Ji-an, what do you have for us today?
Right, so today I'd like to talk about one of the hottest Korean contemporary artists, I think, in the world right now, which is eBay. He has returned home with a deeply personal show at Museum San in Gangwon.
Sounds exciting. I'm really looking forward to getting more into this. Before we do get into the exhibition itself, let's talk about the artist a bit more. Can you give us some more background on eBay?
Absolutely. So his story is actually very closely tied to the themes of this exhibition as well. So Lee was born in 1956 in Cheongdo in North Gyeongsang province into a family of farmers. But obviously, he decided to pursue art, and after studying fine arts in Hongik University in Seoul, he moved to Paris in 1989, looking to expand his artistic horizons. And it was there in Paris that he first began working with charcoal, which is something that he's best known for. Mm-hmm. Since then, he has received many accolades. In France, he was awarded the Chevalier of the Order of Arts and Letters Award in 2018, which is a prestigious cultural honor. And then in Korea, he received the Artist of the Year Award from the National Museum of Modern and Contemporary Art back in 2000. And more recently, the Korea Culture and Arts Award in 2023. So despite being based between Paris and Seoul, his exhibitions have actually been staged more frequently abroad than at home in recent years. So that's why this show at Museum San feels like a homecoming of sorts.
Really interesting background and quite the list of accolades there. And I think that context makes this exhibition sound especially meaningful, Gian. As you said, this is not just a major solo show, but a kind of, return to the places and the memories that really shaped this artist.
Yes.
Given how closely Ibe's work is connected to material and landscape and atmosphere, Museum San feels like a particularly fitting venue. It isn't your typical gallery space, is it?
Not at all. So it's a remarkable venue designed by the Japanese architect Tadao Ando, and it sits in the lush mountain landscape of Wonju in Gangwon. So Ando's architecture is known for its interplay of concrete, light, water, and nature. So it's already a very immersive space before a single work is placed inside. And for Libe, that was both a challenge but also a creative prompt. So the entire exhibition is conceived so that the artworks, the architecture, and the surrounding nature resonate and communicate closely with one another. Visitors are meant to experience the space and not just kind of look at the art on the walls.
Right. In a way, the setting almost becomes part of the exhibition itself. The building, the mountains,
yes.
The works, they sound like they're all in almost a conversation together.
Exactly.
Now, when visitors arrive at Museum San for Ibe's show, what is the first thing that they're going to encounter?
Right, so it's pretty monumental, actually. Right outside the museum's main gallery hall, there's a massive carbonized sculpture called Issue du Feu, which translates from French as Born of Fire. So it's made of 7 tons of charred chunks of wood bound together with ropes, rising 8 meters into the air. It's this like inky black, undulating in form, almost like a living thing. Some listeners might actually recognize a version of it. A similar piece was installed at the New York Rockefeller Center in 2023. So it's had quite a global life.
It's definitely a striking way to begin, almost a statement of intent before visitors, even enter the gallery. And the fact that a related work has appeared, in New York really underlines how internationally recognizable eBay's charcoal sculptures have become.
Mm.
This feels like the perfect moment now to just take a step back and mm-hmm. ask, why charcoal? What drew Ibe to this material? And why has it become, so central to his work?
Yeah, so he's been working with this material for like 30 years now. And in Asia, charcoal is used in ink for paintings and calligraphy. It's also used to heat homes, purify water, air, cooking. So overall, it's like deeply embedded in everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
So when Lee was in Paris, he was looking for something to set his art apart from other artists and came across charcoal at a store in Paris, and something clicked. He started playing around with it and, never looked back. The connection to the material runs deeper than just personal affinity, though. He situates himself as an Eastern voice in what he still sees as a West-centric contemporary art world. And he pointed out that even the critical vocabulary used to discuss Eastern traditions like ink painting, calligraphy, still feels insufficient in Western art discourse. So he uses charcoal deliberately. It's a material that feels familiar and even conventional to many audiences in Asia, but through his work, he hopes that the Western viewers might come to better understand Eastern art and culture. So it's a quiet act of translation, you could say.
It's so interesting. Charcoal isn't just a visual signature for him, but a way of carrying memory, daily life, as you mentioned, and Eastern artistic traditions into a global contemporary art setting. I also love that kind of chance encounter for him just in a store in Paris. Yeah. Has really, you know, been so intrinsic to his career.
Yeah.
Now, the exhibition is called En Attendant, Waiting. Somewhat unusual title. What's behind it?
Yeah, so it came from a very personal place. In preparing for this show, Lee said he found himself reflecting on his roots, who he is, where he came from, what he had dreamed of until now. And he described approaching this exhibition as a farmer digging the earth while praying. Mm. He even recalled his past when he told his father that he wanted to become an artist. And his father was apparently actually very firmly against it. And he had hoped that Lee would continue farming. Mm-hmm. So those early tensions between duty and personal calling stayed with him deeply. And through that process, he arrived at this idea of waiting, not as passively, but as a state of longing. Mm. He described it as a state of mind marked by incompleteness, by a lack, and by a lingering sense of missing something. So it's very meditative rather than resigned.
And Jian, what exactly does that look like, you know, across the whole exhibition itself?
Yeah, the show unfolds across 39 works, including sculptures, installations, paintings, and one video. There are new pieces, though they extend the practices that he has maintained for about 3 decades of his career. One standout series is 6 towering bronze sculptures called Brushstroke, placed in the museum's stone garden outside, overlooking the Kangwon Mountains. They stand like 10 meters tall, deliberately matching the height of Ando's building and the surrounding trees. Lee said those were inspired by a visit last November to the site of the devastating wildfire in Kangwon that burned, I think, through roughly like 360,000 square meters of land. So there's grief in them, but also kind of a dignified endurance. Mm-hmm. And then inside the museum, there are 16 calligraphy-inspired charcoal ink paintings titled also Brushstroke, displayed in what was once the museum's lounge area. It floods with natural light through floor-to-ceiling windows, and it's a beautiful contrast between this ancient medium and the contemporary light and space.
So the title really seems to carry through the whole exhibition, the sense of time, aftermath, quiet reflection. Those outdoor brushstroke sculptures sound especially powerful to me. Mm. As you mentioned, responding to a real landscape, you know, marked by fire, while the works inside bring that charcoal back into a calmer, you know, kind of more contemplative space. And of course, most important question, Jian, for listeners who want to go and see this exhibition for themselves, when does it run until?
Right, so En Attendant, Waiting runs through December 6th.
Okay, so a bit of time for any of our listeners who do want to go and see that. Wonderful. Again, eBay's En Attendant, Waiting runs through December 6th at Museum San in Wanju, Gangwon Province. A chance to see how charcoal, fire, memory and landscape come together in one of his most personal exhibitions to date. Jian, thank you so much for introducing us to eBay's work today.
Thank you, Alana.
And that's a wrap for today's edition of Korea 24. Don't forget to tune in again tomorrow. We've got more stories, interviews and insights you won't want to miss. I've been your host, Alana Hill. Thanks for joining me and goodbye.
KBS World Radio strives to promptly update our listeners on safety procedures during emergency situations. The following are recommended guidelines to follow in the case of an earthquake. During an earthquake, you are advised to stay indoors. Going outside could be extremely dangerous, as you could be hit by shattering windows or falling signs. While indoors, turn the gas off and go under a table or desk to protect your head. Refrain from using gas or electricity until after it is confirmed to be safe. If you're in an elevator, promptly get off and seek shelter. If you're on the street, cover your head with your hands or bags and stay away from brick walls and gates. If you're driving, stop your car on the right side of the road. Before seeking shelter, close your car windows and leave your keys in the ignition, then get out of your vehicle. once the ground stops shaking, request help for the injured while remaining mindful of possible aftershocks. Please check our website at world.kbs.co.kr for up-to-date information and procedures.
Yeah.